Okay, so we're looking at Tillim 126. Are there any verses here? Yeah, just to quickly refresh. And then are there any verses here that seem out of place, that don't necessarily seem to fit with everything else going on? It's only six psukim, so it's not so hard. But let's take a look anyway.
I don't know, it seems like they're talking about joyful things with Hashem, and then it says, line 4, return our captivity, Hashem is the streams in the dry land.
Okay, right, so we talk about... Right, the mood in Pasuk 4, right, seems to shift. We're previously very joyous. Hayinu semechim, we rejoice, we're singing, we're, you know, calling out from among the nations, we're generally very happy, and then return our captivity. Right? I thought things were good. What do we mean, return our captivity? Okay, that's one kind of disjoint. Anything else? Seem to not quite fit with what we think this chapter's about?
Well, it seems that we didn't yet get there. In other words, the beginning is praise for what Hashem has done for us. Wonderful thing. And here we seem we didn't get there yet.
Okay. And you think that's the continuation, like starting from Pasuk Daled, but okay. So good. This is probably the key question that we have to try to answer when looking at this chapter. The first couple of psukim seem very positive. We've accomplished something. We're rejoicing. And then the next three psukim take us backwards. All of a sudden, we're still in captivity.
Yeah.
All of a sudden, Hazarim Bidim'ah. There are tears. Tears are not usually, you know, these don't seem to be happy tears. These are sad tears. So how do we explain the shift from the beginning of our chapter, where we're dreamers, we're joyous, to the end of the chapter, where we're crying and we're, you know, asking Hashem to save us? That's probably the main question. And I think we also sort of identified intuitively where we might draw the dividing line in our chapter, right? After Pasuk Gimel, Higdil Hashem La, so Imanu Hayinu Semechim, that seems to be the end of theme number one. And theme number two seems to begin with Pasuk Daled. Shuvah Hashem et Tzvitenu, redeem us, because we have not yet been freed from captivity. That phrase, Tzvitenu, is a bit weird. We may touch on it in more detail in just a moment. Okay, so that's one question that we're going to try to unpack, and that I think will lead us to maybe more sophisticated reading of our chapter. We'll note now, just I think structurally, very quickly at the outset, why it's so clear that these two sections really kind of mirror each other, but the similarities and the differences between the two sections of our chapter, the first three and the last three psukim. Then we'll read through the chapter in order as we go in our normal manner and try to figure out through that what maybe is changing in the middle of the chapter. And we'll conclude by looking at some other parallel places in Tanakh where maybe some of these themes or some of this language appears and see if that sheds any further meaning on that progression of the chapter. So just firstly to note some of the kind of obvious examples, it's clear that our first three psukim and our last three psukim parallel each other. We know that intuitively, I think most of us, without putting words to it, because when we sing this right before benching, right, it's usually the same tune twice. You start first, Shira Malz, Shuvah Shem Etzivaseh, and then you start again, the same exact tune, Shuvah Shem Etzivaseh. Right, we kind of know that that's the division, and we kind of match those two lines, and they're approximately the same length, because the same tune fits for both of them. It doesn't feel particularly awkward. And there's also a lot of shared language from the first three to the last three. So anyone see any shared charashim or shared words from the beginning to the end of the chapter? Right, so Shuv is definitely a good one. At the beginning, you have Shuv Hashem et Shivat Zion. That's twice. And then in Pasuk Daled, Shuv Hashem et Shivitenu. It's a very similar language there. Anything else? Rina, so I pulled that for you. You have Azimale Schok Penu Ul Shorenu Rina in Pasuk Bet, and in Pasuk Hei and Vav, Hazorim Bidima Berina Yiktsoru. Those who sow in tears will reap with joy, with Rina. There's another piece of language that seems to filter from the top to the bottom. And there's one more that we'll note in just a moment. This actually is within one section. In Psukim Bet and Gimel, you have this phrase, Higdil Hashem la'asot im. And that also, right, so im eila in Pasuk Bet, im manu in Pasuk Gimel. And that also seems to match. So we'll have to look at that as well. But you see that these two halves are definitely lined up with each other. A lot of shared language that makes you think they're overlapping in some way. Okay, so let's read from the beginning and see if we could try to resolve this sort of apparent contradiction, right? The contradiction between the first part, where it seems like we've already been saved and we're looking back. When Hashem redeemed us from Shivat Zion, we were like dreamers. Even the grammar fits. Hayinu kecholmim, hayinu semechim. Those are past tense verbs. As opposed to Shuva Hashem et Shivitenu. It's an imperative. Do this for us in the future, in the second half. So how do we resolve this contradiction? That's our key question. So let's start reading from the beginning. Shir Hama'alot. This is Shir Hama'alot. There are 14 other Shirei Hama'alot in Tehillim. We're looking only at one now. And in the interest of time, we're not going to look at all the different interpretations of what Shir Hama'alot could possibly mean, the ways that all the Shir Hama'alot might relate to each other. That's a whole conversation just about the term. And in these classes, we haven't really been focusing on those headers, those introductions. They tend to be a bit oblique to us. Bishuv Hashem at Shivat Zion, when Hashem returned Shivat Zion. What is Shivat Zion? If you have to give an English translation.
So that's,
I think, probably the more natural way to go. It's a bit funny in English, but I think it works. The returning, when Hashem returned, the returning of Zion. Yeah, or right, those who returned, maybe, of Zion. Mm-hmm. So it kind of doubles up in a way that isn't so natural in English. But you have the sense that there are those who are meant to be returned. It's almost like their destiny to go back to their home, back to their earlier, you know, redeemed state. And Hashem facilitated that. Some commentaries also explain Bishuv Hashem et Shivat Zion. So et could be what they call in linguistics, a direct object marker. He returned them. They're the object. Hashem is the one doing the action of returning on the object of the people. It could also mean with.
Yeah.
So it could be Hashem is returning with us almost, and so to speak, we were in exile. Hashem also, so to speak, went to exile with us, and we're all returning together to Zion, back to Israel, back to the Yerushalayim and the Mikdash. Okay. Hayinu kecholmim. We were like dreamers. Okay. What? There's a book like this also in English. Yeah. Who's the author? Yossi Klein Halevi? Is he the author of Lake Dreamers?
I forget.
It's about a lot of the soldiers involved in recapturing Yerushalayim after, I guess, in the Six Day War. So I haven't actually read the book, but looking forward to it one day. It seems appropriate now, Neil Matzmut. Maybe for Yom Yerushalayim, I'll try to get it in. Anyway, so what do we mean by dreamers? What connotations do dreams have that are important for understanding Shivat Zion?
Unexpected things.
Okay, dreams are unexpected, meaning when you dream things, they don't always fit well with reality. There are certain things that only happen in dreams. This is the Ibn Ezra in source number 4. Radak quotes Ibn Ezra as saying that. V'achacham Rabbi Ibn Ezra Peresh, he explained, Ken Yom Rabbi Yisrael, this is what Israel will say, B'shuv ha-kel et shivutam. When Hashem returns, they're returning. Ein Adam Roa Be'enav Befela Hazeh Rak Bechalom. A person never sees these kinds of things with their eyes, they only dream them. You can only imagine what Shivat Zion is like. You can't actually live it and experience it. It's almost like beyond our comprehension. And then that doesn't mean it's impossible, obviously it's going to happen, but it's something that's basically unimaginable. So that's one quality of dreaming that's relevant, kind of the like unworldly, you know, ethereal sense of a dream. What else is relevant in thinking about dreaming? There are a few other interpretations that you see in the commentaries.
I like the Malvin that says, who sees the future as though it is the present.
Okay, so that's almost really almost the opposite idea, right? A dream, understands chalom as a sort of prophetic dream, right, which you have in Nevi'im, sometimes the word chalom connotes that kind of prophecy. And it's almost the reverse, right? In a dream, things are often so vivid to you, where people have very vivid, lucid dreams, so you experience things almost as though they're present, or especially a prophetic dream, where you really experience it in a way that's very alive. And so this is a very vivid dream, and for Malbim, he said in the beginning of this passage, Husad Begalut Bavel al Shivat Zion v'Hagola. This chapter was written while they were in exile, so you can almost imagine the people that are in exile, and it's worth remembering, for the first time, right, we're sitting here, we've been in exile for 2,000 years, so, okay, 70 years of exile, it's not such a big deal. But that was the first exile. That was the exile where, are we even sure we're going to come back? This is the first time we've ever been away from our homeland. So to imagine them experiencing exile and then having this vivid prophetic realization that they're coming back, that would be a huge surge of hope and optimism for the people. I think that's another contribution of dreaming that might be the case. Rashbam here, or this is a commentary attributed to Rashbam, the way he describes a dream, it seems to be something that is, you know, also a hope, but not in the sense that I have prophetic knowledge that it will happen. You know, the opposite of that. The idea of hope that I dream for things, I hope and yearn for things that feel impossible, and then all of a sudden you wake up and they're right in front of you. And that kind of hit that you would get when you're realizing, wow, everything I dreamed of has all come true. And this is the fulfillment of years of longing and desire. So that would be incredibly powerful as well. The final connotation you see in commentaries, and there are more nuances, but Radak quotes his father in source number 4, that the dream isn't the redemption, the dream is actually the exile. The exile will be so fleeting like a dream. You have a horrible nightmare, and okay, you wake up and you're a little perturbed, but very quickly you realize that the nightmare was just a nightmare, it wasn't real, and now the real world is the one where this gets to happen, where we get to be redeemed and brought back. And a lot of different interesting connotations, and you know, one of the things that it's too tempting to compare what we see here to what we've experienced in, you know, our own lifetimes and in recent years, obviously our current redemption in Israel, and also the idea that we would go from, let's say, 1945 to 1948, that is a tremendous transition to have experienced. And many of these connotations of dreaming, whether the idea of, you know, the past being almost like a fleeting dream, and Israel now, compared to the Jewish world in the 1920s and 30s, that's a tremendous, you know, unimaginable transition. And then Israel now compared to Judaism in the 1940s, all the more so. But the, you know, tremendous upheaval, almost a miraculous quality that you couldn't have imagined, and yet has come true. I think it's very tempting and natural to read our Mizmor in light of our days, which I think works very well. Okay, so that is Cholmim. We were like dreamers, and indeed are like dreamers now. Az yimaleis chok pinu ulshonenu rina. Then our mouths... I'm going to translate it in the past tense. I know it doesn't look like a past tense verb. Yimale usually looks like a future tense, but sometimes this phrase, az future tense verb, it means past tense. The most famous example of this is az yashir. Then Moshe will sing. Obviously it means then Moshe sang, right after getting out of Yom Suf. So here I'm going to read it as the past tense as well. Az yimale schok pinu, then our mouths were full of... schoke of like mirth or laughter. Ulshonenu rina, and our tongues of rina, of some kind of joy. And we want to read these few psukim in a progression. So we started out as dreamers. What we're talking about is almost unbelievable, right? Like incomprehensible. And then we're starting to process it, and we start laughing. We're joyous, but laughter. Right, psychologists would tell you laughter is often the result of things that are unexpected. You don't expect this to happen. So first it's a dream. I don't even know if this is real. Then you start realizing and processing, oh, this is actually happening, and it's just like a kind of bursting forth of emotion, of joy, of schok and rina. It's not even necessarily something we could put into words. It's just something that we're feeling so intuitively, joyously. We'll actually continue to the next book, and we'll turn to the next verse in just a second. Az Yomru, then the nations said, Bagoyim, among the nations, Higdil Hashem la'asot im ela. God has done great with these. God has done great things for these. Some commentaries debate whether this is positive or negative. Right? When they say, oh, God is great with that one, the connotation is almost dismissive, right? Those people God did really, really well for. But I think most commentaries understand this positively. Even other nations will see how tremendous, how amazing the modern developments are. We'll touch on that theme in just a second, but it's also worth noting that same phrase, Yimaleis Chok Pinu, from the beginning of the Pasuk, appears in Iov, Pasachet, Ad Yimaleis Chok Picha Usvatecha Trua, and there... it seems to be that the connotation is other foreign nations or other enemies, people who hate us, will themselves be undercut. And that seems to be the inversion, right? Back when we're in exile, the nations mock us and laugh at us, and we're, Eicha describes how, you know, we're the laughing stock of all the nations, and now we're being returned, and the nations are giving us praise. So Azim Alei Zchok Picha will rejoice when our enemies themselves are, you know, undercut. And that theme certainly works. And then we'll finish the section before we go to the rest of the commentary here. So back to Pasuk Gimel. Higdil Hashem la'asot imanu. The nations just said, Higdil Hashem la'asot imela. And then we say, Higdil Hashem la'asot imanu. Hashem did great things with us. Right? Obviously, that's very similar to what the Goyim had just said, which is interesting. It sounds like we almost got the idea from them. Right? They said, Hashem did great things for us. And then we said, oh, wow, you're right. This is a really big deal.
Maybe because, no, I think the other way, that even the Goyim had to, you know, the Goyim had to recognize that Hashem did this for us.
Okay, so you're saying, like, the real chiddush of these psukim, or the real novel idea, is that the non-Jews recognize it. Of course, we're going to recognize it, but the main idea is, wow, even they see it.
Right, that's what I would say.
So I think that's...
Those who say that, you know, we're... All these theories about the Jewish people that it's either our end, that we have no future, we're despised by Hashem, we've been replaced by other religions. So they have to admit that Hashem did great things for us. They're not for that.
Right. So it could be, one way to read these psukim is to say, when the non-Jews say, Higdil Hashem la'asodim eile, then we respond, oh, it's so good that even they agree to it.
Right?
We're rejoicing because even other nations see how great things are for us. And that's a positive development on our end. That could be. I think this is one way the commentaries take it. I was partial to a different reading where the ability for us to say, Higdil Hashem la'asod imanu, is almost because they were able to recognize it, right? If we're following the progression I hypothesized before, right? We start by not even recognizing that it's real. Hayinu kecholmim. Then we recognize it, but we can't put words to it. We're just kind of joyous in this, like, abstract, unformed way. And all of a sudden, we hear someone else, an outside observer, maybe a more neutral observer, who's able to put words to it, explain how great it is that Hashem did this for us, and then we're able to do it too. And all of a sudden, our tzchok, Azim Alei Tzchok Pinu, turns to simcha, hayinu simechim, we were joyous. We're not dreamers now. It's not abstract, it's not ethereal, it's not hypothetical or unbelievable. Mm-hmm. It's real, and it causes us simcha, mm-hmm. Right? When Sarah finds out she's going to have a kid, right, it's tzchok. She almost doesn't believe it. It's, you know, it's laughable. And even positive laughter, but still, like, unexpected, as opposed to simcha, which is a very natural state. When things are as they should be, you experience simcha. That's a nice positive but development that you could articulate clearly. Higdil Hashem la'asot imanu. I brought, just because I made the connection here, this is a book by Rabbi Sacks, A Letter in the Scroll. And in the introduction, or in the preface, and the preface, the prologue. So he talks about how he was working with a student group on campus, and he asked them, he suggested, oh, they should write to a number of prominent Jews in many important fields and ask them what Judaism means to them. And he was very disappointed by the response. A lot of Jews were, Judaism is just something that, you know, makes me comfortable, or, you know, even a more negative formulation, Judaism is a hereditary illness that you get from your parents and pass along to your children. I'll read the quote. It's a cute quote. It's, in Israeli, prominent in public life in Israel and the diaspora. So they were asked to define Judaism. He said, Judaism is a hereditary illness. You get it from your parents and pass it along to your children. And why call it an illness? Because not a small number of people have died from it. Which is certainly not a positive reading of Judaism. And then right afterwards, Rabbi Sacks quotes a number of prominent non-Jewish thinkers in describing Judaism, and the formulation is so different. Leo Tolstoy. The Jew is that sacred being who was brought down from heaven, the everlasting fire, and has illuminated with it the entire world. He is the religious source, spring, and fountain, out of which all the rest of the peoples have drawn their beliefs and their religions. And he also has other quotes from John Adams and Paul Johnson, who's a historian and editor of a newspaper, William Rees Mogg, all these, you know, secular, non-Jewish intellectuals who are able to have a perspective on Judaism that, when we hear it, becomes something that resonates with us, that maybe is something that's hard for us to think of or articulate on our own. Whether because it's kind of hard to toot your own horn, like, you don't want to be the one to say that Judaism is the most important thing to ever happen, but when you hear someone else say it, we're very happy to kind of lean into that. That could be. Or it could just be someone with an outsider's perspective can contextualize things, right? We say it's very hard to be a Jew. Yeah, you know, things are so expensive and the rules are so difficult. But at the end of the day, someone who has a broader view of history is able to appreciate the meaning of it all. And that maybe that's hinted to in this mizmor as well. Right? When the goyim are able to appreciate this, then we also are able to appreciate it as well in a way that's deeper or more nuanced than we might appreciate it on our own. And I think if the chapter ended here, that would be a perfectly nice little chapter of Tehillim in which everything is great and we're being redeemed and brought back. And everything's really wonderful. And let's just to round out this sort of the positive half of the chapter. So, in source number 6, this is Rav Elchanan Samet, and there's a number of really nice essays and books on Sefer Tehillim. So he explains the context historically for the non-Jews appreciating the good news. Why do the nations think the Lord did great things for these? The answer seems to lie in the uniqueness of the process of return of those who return from the Babylonian exile to their homeland. So he's contextualizing it in, you know, Golus by Rishon, right, in Babel. Many nations were exiled from their lands by the kings of Assyria and Babylonia over the course of 200 years that preceded the Persian conquest of Babylonia. To the best of our knowledge, however, none of these nations returned to their homelands other than the Jews who were exiled to Babylonia. Koresh's proclamation set in motion the return to Zion that came in its wake, the renewal of settlement in Judea with political rights, limited as these may have been, and the rebuilding of the temple and restoration of Jerusalem and its walls. All of these constitute a unique phenomenon in the history of the ancient world, and I love this last line. Had it not been for the return of Jews to their homeland in recent generations, it might well have remained a unique phenomenon in all of history. In other words, the fact that a nation could be exiled from their homeland and come back is incredible and singular to the experience of Jews in history. And so what are the non-Jews recognizing? They're recognizing that there's a fate that the Jewish people seem to have that is completely unlike anything else that has ever happened. And again, if it was true then, all the more so can we imagine that it's true now in the 20th, 21st centuries. History's gone on a lot longer, and we've seen what has and hasn't happened. Okay, so that's all half number one. But the problem is the second half. So we'll start with one idea of the second half, and then we'll try to offer more. So the second half of the chapter continues, or begins, Shuvah Hashem et Shivitenu ka'afikim banegav. Return our returning, return. Some understand this to refer to the Shoresh Shivya, meaning our exiles, or our captives. So that there's obviously, the language is obviously related, it's a different Shoresh in Hebrew. So either return our captives, return our captivity, or just return our returning, either way, ka'afikim banegav. And I think to better appreciate our first possible reading, it's important to have a little bit of historical context or background, specifically to Bavel and the exile there. So we did return. If you read books Ezra and Nehemiah, we return, and we have a clear document of that. And the return was lackluster, right? In many ways, right? We have lots of examples, if anyone's studying Ezra and Nehemiah recently. Just to give a few. So who's returning? The answer is, or how many people are returning? Not so many. 40-some-odd thousand people return. Which people are they? They're not the elite. They're poorer people in the nation. And they come, and they find the land to be desolate. And they find their enemies in the land who are opposed to rebuilding the Beit HaMikdash. And they find, which I'll note in source number 9, Haggai, the Navi, acknowledges this, they find that there's a drought, and there's famine, and things are not going so well agriculturally. And Ezra and Nehemiah find that there's a religious collapse and people aren't keeping the Torah and they're intermarrying and they're illiterate. And everything that you might have hoped Shivat Zion would be, right? If you read the books of Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel and all these descriptions of the rebuilding of the land and the resettling of the nation, it doesn't look like what Ezra and Nehemiah look like. Mm-hmm. It looks like a really disappointing return. Shuvah Hashem et Shivitenu on one level means we really wanted it to be great, and it's definitely not complete yet. We had a good start, we came back, that was excellent, and now you need to return us. And I think the way to best understand that is through the image of Afikim Banegev. like streams in the dry land or streams in the south, right? The desert. Has anyone ever seen a rainstorm in the Negev?
No.
I haven't. I don't know that they're necessarily so common. It doesn't necessarily pour in there. So when you talk about streams in the desert, right, so they're rejuvenating. That's one aspect, obviously.
Right.
Yeah, right. It sounds like a wadi, a river that will, you know, causes land to sprout, right? It sounds very nice. But I think with a tighter understanding of the agriculture, which in the interest of time, we won't read the whole passage in source number 8. But instead of reading that, we'll just look at the picture on the front page, actually. So that's a picture of a flash flood that you might see in the Negev. Sometimes you see these in the news, that there's a group of, you know, students on a tiul and flash floods. And it's tragic sometimes.
We had one recently.
Oh, there was one recently.
My brother and sister were swept away.
Aye.
The
yeah. And when you imagine that phenomenon, so you're not imagining a stream that comes and in the spring it rejuvenates the land. We're not asking Hashem to rejuvenate things. We're asking, ka'afikim banega, we're asking for a flood. Right? When we came to Israel the first time, there were a small trickle of people came, 40,000 some odd people came, and the land was not fully inhabited by Jews. We were basically living in Yerushalayim, in one city. Mm-hmm. And we're asking, okay, we had a good start. Shuvah Hashem et shivitenu ka'afikim banegev. I want that flash flood. I want the, you know, rain far away to rush in here, and all the people who had not yet returned to flood the land. And that's obviously one difference between the way things work out then and the way things are working out, you know, this time around, where now we have almost a majority of the Jews in the world living in Israel. There was a much stronger, more aggressive rush to fill that land than there had been in the past. But the tefillah, on one level, is we got a Shivat Zion, and it was great, and we do appreciate the historical novelty of it, and at the same time, we're missing something. We're missing the rush of people to inhabit the land, which would solve many other problems also. A rush of people means that the land can be more fully developed. It means we have more people to defend Yerushalayim against our enemies, which was a major concern in Ezra and Nehemiah. And we'll be able to have an easier time building the Mikdash, and we'll have more funds, and we'll have more political clout, and all of these things that we need to make the country thrive, ka'afikim banega, that's what we're asking for. That's one level of what's going on there. And I think it works, right? You talk about the chalom, we had the dream of what could be, and we realize the reality is a little bit messier. The thing that remains for us is Pesukim Hey and Vav, 5 and 6, which, you know, if you read them out of context, they almost don't belong in Tehillim at all. They really seem to be Pesukim, like Sefer Mishlei Pesukim. It's telling you a lesson. Hazorim bidima berina yiktsoru. If you, you know, people who sow their seeds, even though it's difficult and it's hard work, and you may cry because it's just very difficult to do, you'll celebrate when your crop actually grows. And then it elaborates in Pasuk Vav. You'll be, you know, working hard, carrying your seeds into the field, but then when the seeds sprout, you'll be celebrating. And the moral of the lesson really is put in hard work because hard work pays off and you'll get to celebrate at the end. Feels like it doesn't really fit. It fits a little bit the agricultural kind of imagery of Afikim Banegev, but I think it's a little bit limited in terms of whether it directly relates to the idea of redemption in a direct way. I think we might get a better sense, though, when you look at some of the parallels, some of the places the language from our parak appears in other parts of Nach. So starting with source number 10 is Sefer Yoel. So these are both descriptions of, you know, eventual redemption. So in Yoel you see this phrase, etatzfoni, start at the end of Pasuk Chaf, ki higvil Hashem la'asot, al tiri adama gili, don't be afraid, land, you should rejoice. Gili usmachi, you should be sameach. Hayinu semechim. Ki higdil Hashem la'asot. Hashem has done great things. And what's the great thing? Well, al tiru b'hamot sadai. Ki dashu ne'ot midbar. The pastures of the wilderness have sprung up. Ki eitz nasa perio. Trees have borne their fruit. V'gefen natnu chelam. And the vines have brought forth their strength. And uvenei tzion, the children of Tzion, the people living or who would live in Tzion, gilu v'simchu, rejoice, b'Hashem Elokeichem. Ki natan lechem hamore litzdaka, v'yored lechem geshem, more umakosh barishon, and rain will come. So this is a prophecy about the rejuvenation of the agriculture in the land. And the phrase higil Hashem la'aso, which we recognize from our chapter as well, is the great thing Hashem did for us is causing the land to sprout again. And obviously, again, we think about our days in which the land has certainly been reborn. You know, if we all know those quotes from Mark Twain about how desolate the land was and how it has certainly been flipped now. So when we say Hashem has done great things for us, that's agricultural. On a one level, that's what we want. When we talk about redemption, we mean the land itself should flourish.
Isn't that a pasuk in Lecha? You become better fruit until you see the tree that
you are. It's a Gemara in, I think, Masechet Sanhedrin, right? It's a lot of religious Zionist thinkers quote it. When you see the land sprouting, you know we're in the days of Mashiach. Mm. I don't have the source here. But it's also already prefigured, you know, in the times of the Nevi'im as well. So on one level, the point of Hazorim Bedima is earlier we said things are starting to turn up, but things are still challenging. We're still in famine, you know, there's still droughts, and we still need Hashem to help the redemption kind of take root, so to speak, and pun definitely intended. But on the other hand, there's the sense in which the agriculture is also tied in with the broader national redemption. It's more reflected in the Pesukim in Amos as well. Hine yamim ba'im neum Hashem, days are coming soon. V'nigash choresh ba'kotzer, talking about kotzrim, v'dorech anavim, v'mosheh hazara, nosei mesha hazara, from our chapter, v'itihu ha'arim asis v'chol ha'gvo'ot tidmogagna, all of these descriptions, I'll read the English, I need to feel it right now. The plowman shall overtake the reaper, and the one tending grapes him who sows seeds. Sweet wine will drip from the mountains and flow from the hills. And with this agricultural renewal, and tied up with it, even the same language we often use describing the agricultural renewal, we also describe the physical renewal of the nation. Vishavti et shvut ami Yisrael, v'shuv Hashem et shivitenu, shuv Hashem et shivitenu. Uvarnu arim neshamot will build desolate cities, v'yashavu, and we will inhabit them, v'natu kramim, we will plant vineyards, v'shatu et yeinam, and drink their wine, v'asu ganot, v'achlu et periyam, and eat the fruits of the orchards that we will also plant. Unetatim al admatam, I will plant the people on their land, v'lo yinatshu od me'al admatam, asher natati lahem, and they will not be removed from their land. So just like agriculture is a sign of redemption, we also use agricultural imagery for national redemption. And with that in mind, we could go to Hazorim Bidima Barina Yiktoru. It's on the one level a parable about agriculture and how to best get the fruits of your labor. And it's also, you know, Bedarach Mashal about the nation and how we get national renewal. And national renewal sometimes requires effort and investment and Hazorim Bidima, but it will yield Barina Yiktoru, this celebratory appreciation of that full redemption, right? So before we were saying, you know, one level is appreciating that Hashem needs to do more work, and we still need to dive into Hashem for the full redemption to take hold. And the second level of it is that we also need to put in the work for the redemption to take hold. The best mashal for this is in Sefer Bereishit, because there are two words that appear in our parak that also appear in Sefer Bereishit in the context of the Yosef story, chalomot, right? Yosef obviously has dreams, and what's in his dreams? Alumot. Bo yavo verina no se alumotav. We carry in our bundles of wheat. Right. Alumot only appear in those two parts of the Torah. Only in Bereishit Lamed Zayin in those dreams and in our Perek of Tehillim as well. And the Midrash picks up on it. In the Midrash in Parshat Vayigash in source number 13. The Midrash says all of the things that happened to Yosef will likewise happen to Tzion, meaning the national entity of Bnei Yisrael in the future. And it quotes these psukim. Yosef has dreams of binding alumim together. And also, Boyav Overina no Sayalu Motav. Yosef has dreams, and Hayinu Kicholmim, we will be like dreamers. And to what aspect of the Yosef story is really relevant here? Well, what happens to Yosef? Yosef has dreams. Yosef has. Yeah, but what happens in between?
Zorim Bedima.
Oh, right, exactly, right? Yosef is paradigmatically Zorim Bedima. He is betrayed by his brothers and sent down to slavery and descends into a pit. And builds himself up in Paro's household in, coincidentally, handling agriculture and gathering together alumim. That definitely is obviously not a coincidence. But Yosef himself is able to build Geula out of Dima. And if we're trying to borrow Yosef as a model by referring to the alumim, referring to the chalomot, so we can also think of our modern redemption in the same way. So we have a, you know, if one or sort of summarize the whole reading of our parak. So everyone agrees. We start at the beginning and things are great and we're appreciating our redemption. We're able to articulate it clearly and experience joy and it's wonderful. And then real life hits, sets in, and we see it's not as simple. And you look at how everything that went wrong in the books of Ezra and Nehemiah and all the complications that we have nowadays building a state and all the conflict associated with it. And we feel two needs, and that's what the second half of the mizmor is about. First, Shuvah Hashem et Shiviteinu ka'afikim ba'negev. We daven, we ask for Hashem's help in bringing out a full redemption. And Hazorim b'dima barina yiktoru, because we also have to put in the legwork. And the legwork is hard and it's painful and it causes tears. But is that legwork, you know, both in the agriculture of the land, but more importantly in the development of our own national rebirth and, you know, flowering in the land. We also need to put in the dima, and we also, please God, b'mehera v'yameinu, will experience the rina as well. So with that, I think we'll go with Chag Ha'atzmaut Sameach. I think that's one of the greetings. I never quite know. Yeah, it was wonderful learning with everyone today. Thanks so much. Can I